This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Kumarini Silva grew up in Sri Lanka in a time of civil war. She was mostly sheltered from the violence because her father was a diplomat with the UN, but Kumarini still witnessed the horrors of war and its damaging effects on communities. Her family provided refuge for people fleeing persecution. Meanwhile, bombs exploded near her house in the capital city of Colombo. When she was a teenager, Kumarini's family moved to Liberia, but they had to leave after a few years because a violent coup erupted inside that country. And these experiences shaped her views on the treatment of minority populations and how labeling people as other often leads to oppression. Kumarini felt this personally when she moved to the United States for college. She says the hostility only got worse after 9/11. Today, Kumarini Silva teaches how media and global politics influence perceptions of race and gender. She's a professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill and joins me now. Kumi, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's lovely to be back.
Tell us more about growing up in Colombo, Sri Lanka, when you were there, and tell us more about your family.
So I grew up, I was born in 72 in Sri Lanka, and lived there for a couple of years and then moved to England for a year with my father who and my parents and my sister because my dad was on a postdoc at Cambridge. And one of the things that I find really interesting is that my memories of kind of racial injustice really came out of the stories my parents tell me of my time there, our time there, and that these were the stories that were the backdrop to growing up in Sri Lanka. So we would hear very funny stories that we were supposed to laugh at because one of my dad's favorite stories is that the doorman at Cambridge in his building would not let him in because he thought that my dad was a delivery guy and should take the back entrance, and another fellow had to come up behind him and say, no, he's one of the fellows here. He can take the front entrance. And my dad would like laugh uproariously at this. And we would laugh along with him until I grew older and realized, oh my God, this is terrible. But I think that kind of sums up my upbringing in Sri Lanka, kind of this yin yang of great tragedy with a sense of humor. And that this was the way that people dealt with the Civil War, I think, and that it's very much part of a country that, we've been colonized before independence from Britain in 1948 for 750 years.
Well, and this points to some of the complexity, too, particularly in your case. In your father's case, this is discrimination. He goes to England. He has a brown body and therefore is asked to use the back door. But he is a fellow. He's a postdoc. He's somebody who has a bright future. Mm-hmm. And so he's got some form of privilege. Now you go back to Sri Lanka, where you're a member of the majority population, Sinhalese population. Again, some privilege here. Although, remember, this has been a place that was colonized for centuries.
So it's a complex space to occupy. And I am Sinhalese and Buddhist, so I am very much part of the majority. But I grew up in a household where politics, two things were primary, politics and art. And these conversations happened over dinner tables, at dinner tables, very loudly. My family talks very loudly over each other's voices all the time. And I grew up with a very large extended family. My father has two sisters and my mother had four siblings, but only one is alive now. And we all lived fairly close to each other, and we would get together most evenings, and the adults would have gin and tonics, and the kids would play cricket and badminton. So in one sense, it feels, in retrospect, a very kind of bucolic childhood. But in 83, when I was 11, the riots, the war seemed very distant till that point, and I don't even really think I understood what was really happening. Until the riots came to Colombo. And then things just became very real for even 11-year-old.
This was the explosion of tensions that had been building between a Tamil minority and the Sinhalese majority in the post-colonial Sri Lanka.
Yes. And the the Tamil separatists had killed 13 soldiers. And in retaliation, in Colombo, the Sinhalese population, a largely working class activist population, decided to retaliate by burning down and destroying homes, killing Tamils. And my parents, who I think are very committed, not I think, I know, are very committed pacifists, and who are, like most Sri Lankans, I think, of their generation and their education, not look at issues in very complex terms. And for them, this was obviously not right. But it was very clearly not right. So we did end up, you know, trying to help friends out and moving friends around to safer places. But we were not unusual in that. I think there were many Sinhalese who did that at that particular time.
Before the outburst of violence in 83 and then a protracted civil war, punctuated by a number of violent episodes, was there much discussion about the underlying problems and whether or not the Tamil had some grievances here that needed to be addressed? Or were, in other words, was this a political topic before the outbreak of violence?
Yes, I do remember this, partly because we always went on road trips because my father, before he joined the UN when I was 11, was an academic. He was the head of the geography department in Colombo. And he would go on research trips and we would go along with him. And I remember... my father is also somebody who, my dad has not seen a potential adventure or something thrilling that he can ever pass up on. So I remember when I was about 8, we were going on this road trip and we had just found out that, you know, 45 minutes or an hour away, that there had been an LTTE attack on a community. And my dad was very interested in going close enough to see, kind of understand the politics of it. And I remember he and my mom just having, my mom saying, no, I'm not taking these two little girls and going to this place for you to understand the politics of a situation. But those were conversations that were very public. I also remember elections were very, like presidential elections were really significant. My parents would lay out giant maps of the island on the dining table, and friends would come over. They would stay up the whole night and mark districts out as districts came, numbers came in. And a lot of those conversations were about who's going to vote where, depending on
the ethnic
minorities.
Talking to UNC Professor Kumarini Silva today on the state of things. Talking about your upbringing at the moment in Sri Lanka. So were you aware, because this would be, obviously these are ethnic tensions within a former colony where we know wherever the Europeans have been, whatever ethnic tensions there might have been become much more polarized. Were you aware of the fact that you had were you in a privileged situation? Does the fact that you were the majority, part of the majority, give you privilege, and were you aware of that? Did you?
I don't really think that I was aware of it. I think that it was so much part of how, just life was, and I think that's one of the things that is important to recognize. Right, we're very unaware of our own privileges when we are living through them, and I remember confronting that privilege, I suppose, at 11, to some extent. But also just kind of going back to the way things were once, you know, things settled down.
And as you suggested, your parents were actually protecting people who were at risk as well.
They were. And we did have, you know, we had friends stay with us a few nights in our house. And then my dad managed to get another friend. Who happened to be, he was a Dutchman who was working on a project with my father and who was less likely to be stopped on the street to be checked. He brought his pickup truck and piled our friends flat on the back of the pickup truck and threw blankets over them and just drove them off. And that they had to do that and get them to a camp because the day before we had been warned that if we were harboring...
These were Tamil.
We had been warned by Sinhalese
yes.
communities that if we were harboring Tamil friends, that our house would be burnt down and that they would come back the next day. So,
and you were, I mean, confronted. I don't know about this particular episode or whether you were targeted, but certainly you were. I mean, there were bombs going off near your home.
Yes, and that, you know, that it's interesting because those things have become so much part of my kind of everyday understanding of my life that the bombs started becoming more frequent as I grew older. So when I was 14, 15, because schools were shut down sometimes they were open. One particular incident was that my sister and I had gone to deliver something and we had parked our car, done the delivery of like something drop off at a friend's house. And we got back into the car and a bomb went off and it was very close by. And we were both deafened by it. And we just kept like talking to each other, but we couldn't hear anything. And my sister drove back and later, we came home to my mom in tears and crying because she knew the bomb had gone off in a particular location and that we were going near there. And she was convinced we were not coming back. And it took us a while to get our hearing back.
I'm going to break right there, and I'm going to come back and hear the rest of this story and then get the rest of your story when my conversation with Kumi Silva continues, a professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill, on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow talking with Kumarini Silva. She grew up in Sri Lanka. Today she's a professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill and studies how media and global politics shape racial and gender identities. We left you last in Sri Lanka after a bomb went off nearby, leaving you and your sister practically deaf, right?
Momentarily. So she and I drove back home to a crying mother who was convinced that we'd gotten blown up because she knew where we were going and where the bomb had gone off. And my sister and I still talk about that, like her experience of driving without hearing. We did get it back in a couple of hours. But those are just very interesting experiences that just the idea that, you know, this was part of my childhood in retrospect is... sometimes startles me.
Well, and again, thinking about how you remember stories, too, and I think this gets to part of what you study in terms of the way media and social construction, social constructs, particularly when they're mediated, can change the way we think about things. You had an experience. It was part of a civil war in which two sides are, you know, sort of fighting against each other, right? So you want to take sides. And then there's the way we tell and retell and retell the story and how that shapes our vision of who these groups are and how we identify with one or the other.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that we tend to do a lot is reduce people to their kind of simple essence. And we tend to see people in very absolute terms. And in doing that, those stories become more and more compelling because that kind of distilled, very narrow representation is what we see a lot of times in the media or how we even talk about those give us the kind of frameworks to talk about people. So even in my research on brownness, one of the arguments I make is that things like brown identity becomes a terrorist identity automatically. We cannot think of either it's an illegal immigrant or a terrorist. If I say brown, that would be probably the first thing that comes to most people's mind. But that those are not the only categories of brownness and hardly the categories of brownness.
Well, let's talk about how these ideas of yours were further shaped as you moved on. Your family moved to Liberia when you were a teenager. First of all, what was behind that move?
So my dad worked for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and he was posted to Liberia. So when I finished my O-levels, because Sri Lanka has a British education system, my my parents wanted me to finish that, and then my sister and I moved with my mom to Liberia. And it was lovely for the time we were there when it was in war. I have wonderful, very fond memories of my time there.
You also have memories of now, I think, looking back. You're the daughter of a UN diplomat, so if you're going through customs, for instance, customs and immigration, it's kind of easy for you, right?
So I've thought a lot about that in terms of exit and entrance, that I often kind of think about the irony. Regardless of what I have paid for in terms of, like, going through a line quickly, whatever that express thing is, I'm always, you know, quote unquote, randomly picked out to be checked. And I always, in the way I think about it and I've started writing about it, I juxtapose that against growing up or being in my late teens and having this little blue diplomatic passport that I would get pulled out of lines, not because I was seen as a threat, but because I was seen as so completely neutral that I didn't even have to go through this long line and I would be, you know, shuttled through. And those are, that's a kind of remarkable difference in the way one person's body is read at different time periods in their lives.
And in both cases, color coding is critical.
Absolutely. And, you know, the color of a little passport is critical.
So you were in Liberia now, and this was a time, and again, you begin to notice these things, but pretty soon, a couple of years in, there's a coup in Liberia as well, right?
Yeah. So my dad came home one day and said, we have 36 hours to pack up and leave. The UN always extracts their non-essential stuff out, which it brings its own kinds of privileges, right? He said, you know, they tell us that the last coup was only 2 weeks and that will be the maximum time we're going to be gone. So, you know, just pack up things and maybe just for safety's sake, put things away. And, you know, like, let's pack up stuff, store things so that if there is any gunfire or anything, things won't be too damaged. Right. We did that and we never went back. My dad did 2 years later to close the project, and I think it was a very hard visit back for him. But my mom and I and sister never went back.
Then from there, we went to Sierra Leone? Was that
to
next?
Senegal.
Senegal was next, yeah.
Yeah. So then we went to Senegal.
And what was happening there?
Because that's where they evacuated us to, and we stayed there for what seemed like years, but I don't think it was. I think it was a year.
You decided to go to the U.S. for college.
I did.
Tell us about that experience. You went to Indiana University in Pennsylvania.
I did.
I like this because you went to Indiana University in Pennsylvania, then Miami in Ohio. So you apparently, your father teaches geography, for goodness sake, and you can't get the names of places together.
I can't get these
together.
Things right. No. And I finally, it was so confusing to my parents. They were so thrilled when I finally went to the University of Oregon because for my PhD, because they kept saying, is it really in Oregon? And I said, yes, it really is in Oregon. They kept saying, it just gets so confusing. You never pick these places that are consistent. Yes, I did go to Indiana University of Pennsylvania. It was a really interesting experience. I had lived in cities all my life and moved around in cities. And Indiana, Pennsylvania is not a big city.
Because you were considering Berkeley, right?
I was considering Berkeley. But I had no idea there was a significant difference, except that one was near the beach. And anything related to water will distract me for days at end. So I thought it would be better to stay somewhere where I would, you know, never leave the house because there were piles of snow and I would actually get work done.
And did it work?
Somewhat.
Because, you know, sometimes boredom can be distracting in a way.
It can. I really did make wonderful friends there, and it was a very critical experience for me, I think, because one was the geographic location itself. I think it was the first time it was the first awakening that, in retrospect, of really kind of recognizing or having an experience of what rural America was like and what it was like to go to college and what it was like to be first generation college, to be with first generation college students, and to kind of recognize those experiences is incredibly powerful. And in contrast to my own experiences of traveling and being raised in a different cultural context. But Indiana, Pennsylvania was, you know, it's nestled in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains.
And you had quite a bus ride.
Oh, yeah, I did. So I first arrived in New York and stayed with cousins for a week. And then we drove up to Harrisburg and visited other cousins. So I'd had this, like, you know, I was in New York, and then Harrisburg isn't super big, but it's still, you know, not very rural. And I had spent all this time with family. And then we decided, I said, oh, it's perfectly fine. Just put me on a Greyhound and I'll just go to Indiana, Pennsylvania, as one would do, right? They put me on a Greyhound. This was in January. And I took the Greyhound and I met two remarkable people on that bus ride. One was a young woman who was going to see her boyfriend. And the other person was another woman who said that she was leaving her husband and two children. She was 29. She was leaving her husband and two children because she had fallen in love with her best friend's brother, who was 19. And this was fascinating to me. And they kept relating their experiences to me and what they were expecting from these reunions with their loved ones. And I was sitting there kind of contrasting my own sense of, like, leaving behind family to this. But we ended up in Indiana, Pennsylvania at 11 o'clock at night in 3 feet of snow. And I was told that taxis did not exist after 8 p.m. in Indiana, Pennsylvania.
This is well pre-Uber, so
yes,
you're on your own.
I was. So I made this interesting decision. The lady with had a very tearful reunion with her 19-year-old boyfriend and offered a ride to me. And I felt like I was an intruder in this very complex relationship. So I declined her very generous offer and then looked around, and these two young men approached me and asked me where I was going. And I said, well, I'm trying to find a taxi. And they said, well, there's no taxi, but we are going to the university. Would you like to walk with us? And I walked with them and as I was walking, I did think, did I, like, make the correct choice? Like, I said no to the ride from the complex relationship, but now I'm walking in the middle of the night with two young men who I don't know, who are dragging my two suitcases and my backpack. But they turned out to be lovely. And it was a kind of shocking experience of arriving in a space.
Yeah. Well, and again, too, the cultural experience, again, the complexity of it, as you've hinted at it just a moment ago, you come from a fairly privileged background and an educated family. You're now going to be among people who are first-generation students. Their families haven't gone there. They may not have had the kind of sophisticated upbringing and travel that you had, and yet you would definitely be somebody who is from out of town, and people would recognize you as not from Indiana, Pennsylvania. So that seems to me a fairly complex relationship you have with your new colleagues and fellow students.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if I would have seen myself as sophisticated, but more that I was, I think that I was very naive. Mm. And I think I didn't understand, certainly my family, my parents have done, you know, and my extended family have are successful in their own ways, but certainly there are several, everybody has generations that have not done as well as some others. So, but I think I had a certain kind of sense that things would be just like they were wherever I went, wherever I had been. And I think I was unprepared for what 18-year-old Americans were like, especially because I was coming in as a 20-year-old. I had taken a gap year.
From a British education system, and so the relationship between students and professors was very different for you.
Yes. I remember sitting in class and thinking, wow, they can talk back. They can argue. I don't, like, you don't just sit there and just take notes and then spit this back up. And that took a lot of time for me to recognize and to, I was quite envious. I mean, that's the way, interestingly, how privilege works, right? Because I was very envious of what I saw as their privilege and sense of comfort in that space and the ability to speak back in a way that I was always incredibly self-conscious about.
Because of your cultural upbringing, what about the fact, how about the fact that you were from a different country? Now, you're somebody here is a foreign student. You're in the United States. Did that in any way inhibit you from talking back?
I think so, because I don't think I was very aware of the United States as a cultural space. I think, especially in Sri Lanka, at the time I was growing up, certainly the American influence is far outweighs British influence in Sri Lanka now. But at the time I was growing up, Britain still had a very tangible presence in terms of even popular culture in the United States. I mean, in Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. So when I came to the United States, it was very hard for me to kind of recognize the everyday practices or to think about how I fit in within those everyday practices because I didn't have a roadmap for it.
Last year, you published a book called Brown Threat, Identification in the Security State. And in that book, you talk about your own experience as a person of color after 9/11. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so I, in the book, I have two, I have several incidents that I talk about, but two certainly stand out to me. One was that when I came back to from Sri Lanka to the United States, I was on this, I think, the second plane that came in after flights had been grounded. Mm-hmm. And I remember that my suitcase was being forcefully at the LA airport. They wanted me to open it, but my hands were shaking because I had never seen this much security. And I couldn't get the padlock open. And the two officers kept saying, let's use a crowbar. Let's get a crowbar. They were looking for pliers to open it. And I remember saying, no, just give me a minute, because if you break the lock, all of my stuff is just, it's never going to make it back to Oregon because nothing would be holding it together. And I finally did manage to get that open. And I think that was a really pivotal moment in suddenly recognizing that my body was different now.
I'm talking to UNC Professor Kumarini Silva today on The State of Things. Well, tell me more about that moment and exactly what that felt like, because, again, this is categorically different. This is not walking through the airport, flashing a diplomatic passport, going to the front of the line anymore.
No, and I think it's that first moment you realize that your body really is in its most full sense a brown body. And I think for me that was just that it was a sense of feeling like I was actually nothing, that nothing was protecting me. And I think that was the biggest fear I had, was suddenly any kind of protection that I had, even in my own, whether it was my own sense of confidence, my own life experience that made me comfortable in strange spaces, none of that was going to be useful anymore.
It's interesting because I'm going to take you back to both Indiana, Pennsylvania, and also Miami University in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Did you have any sense of that there, or did you begin to understand and get the landscape and the roadmap that is U.S. cultural reality?
I did have some of it in Indiana because I remember that the Klan had headquarters close by, and there were days when somebody would say, well, maybe today is not a good day for you to be out or go to the dining hall or something like that. So those were very much realities of my everyday life as an undergraduate there. And then also, so that was, it also didn't make sense to me because I didn't quite understand what the Klan was until I started reading up on it. Mm. Then when I went to Miami, one of the they had started a program teaching undergraduates a class on diversity in their dorm rooms, in their dorm, in the sitting area of the dorm. And I would have to go and teach this class during their meal time when their meals were delivered. And I would talk about issues of diversity and why it was important for, you know, for us to think about people.
Well, tell me, describe that experience. What was that like?
Well, it was very strange because I would go around at about 5 o'clock, and the dorms at Oxford, Ohio, are all of the buildings are Georgian architecture. It's considered one of, I think, the top 10 most beautiful campuses in the country. And they're very ritzy. Like, you have wing-back chairs and fireplaces. And these kids would sit around in their pajamas, in their wing-back chairs, and near the fireplace. And I would be talking about race. And I would be, I often thought of myself as this kind of, it was like a cartoon of a person of color being brought into your midst, being asked to educate these kids.
We're going to talk more about that. I want to get more about that experience and what you've experienced since when my conversation with Kumi Silva continues. She's a professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill, studies how media and global politics influence race and gender, also the author of Brown Threat, Identification in the Security State. And our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Kumarini Silva, a professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill. She looks at the way media and global politics influence the way we understand race and gender. She's the author of the book, Brown Threat, Identification in the Security State. And just before the break, you were telling us about your experience at University of Ohio, Miami at Ohio.
Yeah.
Again, you're confusing your parents and the rest
yeah.
of us. But there you are sort of, well, tell us again, because you're talking about being the diversity coach in these mostly white dorms.
Oh, yeah. Actually, almost completely white, because one of the things Miami is really well known for is that these are kids who they're like the third or fourth generation to go to that school. It's a very, family decision to go there. I think it was a program that was instituted into a dorm that students who were interested in learning about issues of diversity were housed in this one dorm, and a graduate student whose research and interests were in issues of race and gender would go and teach issues of race and gender to these students in the dorm during their dinner hour. But because they were missing dinner in the cafeteria, their dinner would be delivered. But I was not on a meal plan, so I just taught. it was interesting because I think that was one of those moments. I think when we start deconstructing our own privilege and recognizing that maybe we are less privileged than we think we are, that does not happen in one moment. So it wasn't that LA moment in the airport, but this little, right. Moments that kind of build up. I think that was, again, this realization that, wow, my body is laboring to do this. Like, I walk into this space and I put my body on display as a way to educate you, so that the things coming out of my mouth correspond to my body, that in a way that makes sense to you. And I think that was a really kind of profound moment. And then I also realized, I have a lot of my kind of father's way of dealing with this trauma and sense of humor, I think, because I had five very close friends who were international students too. And we would always say that, Miami let in five ugly people a year and we made the cut.
Awful, Kumi. But listen, but let's talk more about that, because on the one hand, all right, you talk about, all right, so I'm going to put my body on the line. You're here. You're kind of the army of the willing. We will talk about diversity. But you also have been in this position where you were privileged and you then sort of come to an awakening about how that plays over and against those who don't. Because privilege isn't the thing you feel when you have it. Yeah. Like the problem is, and when other people challenge you, you say, well, that's not true. I worked hard. My grandfather worked hard. He dug gas lines and I went to school and I studied hard and that's why I'm here. So why can't you do the same thing? Well, so what's it for you teaching those students and understanding that that was kind of the barrier, right, that you had to work through, that they're being honest about their situation but can't quite see it, and knowing what the challenges are, how those barriers don't fall easily. Maybe you can give us some insight into how this works.
So I think one of the really pivotal moments for me, I had started in as an undergraduate and as a grad student reading bell hooks, and she has this very wonderful line where she talks about her own experiences of going through the school process during desegregation. And she points out that the labor of desegregation still fell to the bodies of children of color. And it was their labor that was used over and over again. And I think for me, it was this process of kind of letting go, like recognizing that, yes, part of the system or the structure of the United States is such that it has been implemented socially, economically, structurally, and systematically, that the labor of undoing racial injustice is always up to the people of color to do that.
And it's not an inert system. In other words, it's constantly being reinforced, is it not, through the media and through other messaging?
Absolutely. And that it takes on many manifestations, because I think when we like to think about in the classroom, I always tell my students, don't think in relative terms, because if you say things are much better than they were 10 years ago, 50 years ago, of course they are, right? I mean, absolutely. But that doesn't mean that that's where we stop, or that's okay, or the work has been done, and that there's so much more to undo, or actually even do, because I don't think there's nothing has been done, per se.
Well, let's talk about some of the ways in which media might reinforce this. You've been critical of media coverage around domestic terrorists, particularly when they're always sort of labeled as misguided or somehow mentally or emotionally disabled, and that is the narrative around white male terrorists.
So in the book, I introduce the term misguided patriotism as kind of this, as a framework for thinking about how we talk about domestic terrorists, especially if they're white, and that we don't really think of them as terrorists, but we see them as misguided patriots who, for some reason, just broke. And in that moment of breaking, that they acted out of character. And I have several, in my more recent research, I look at two particular cases. One is the Comet Ping Pong case from the gentleman in Salisbury, North Carolina, who went up to D.C. and thought that there was that whole ring of child prostitutes held in a pizza parlor.
It was the Pizzagate story.
Yes. So I kind of look at how the media framed him. Even during that discussion, they talked about him as a family man, as somebody who loved his children, and this is what motivated him to go out and try and save these children. We talked about it in the murder of the Indian gentleman in Olathe, Kansas, and it was this idea that the shooter had just lost his father and he was grieving. You know, this idea of, we use this concept of filial, like familial love, or filial love, and we extend it to love of country. And we see that as seamless. So it's really something that holds like the core of family together that makes these people break and act on behalf of country. But we see that, we read that as terrorism if the bodies are marked differently. We see it as misguided patriotism if the bodies are marked as white.
And what it also suggests, not only is sort of the way the labeling and the branding works, but also the fact that you would spend the time to get as much background and to go into the detail that we don't often get with the stories of other terror acts.
Absolutely. Like, think about the most recent shooting in Vegas, right? Yeah. Within an hour, we had an image of not of Stephen Paddock, but of his girlfriend. We had information to her address, her birth date. So we had this visual of a woman of color that stood in for this right. white shooter. And that was, and we're still trying to, I was looking up even yesterday, just information on him. And all it says is they're still trying to figure out what the right. motivation was. We don't question the motivation of people of color, right? We don't look.
And if they have complex backgrounds, and if there's all this other nuance and other things, that I can't recall now. And we've looked back at, in preparation for this, to see if those kind of details about the kind of charities they gave to and the way they treated their brothers and sisters, all of that doesn't seem to be in those other stories in the way that we've read.
No, because those things humanize people, because you show them in their complexity, and showing people in their complexity goes against the way we have historically understood colored bodies. They're not meant to be human. They're not meant to be humanized.
Do you think this has to do, this is some form of conspiracy, some way in which people conspire to, you know, shade the narrative, or just a question of the backgrounds of the people who write the stories?
I think neither. I think that it is actually the structure of the very foundation of this country. I always tell my students, we have to recognize that the Constitution was written to defend the rights of a small group of white men. And actually, we reproduce those structures over and over again by going back to this Constitution and interpreting it exactly the way it was meant to be interpreted, right? Or in some cases, not.
And initially, only the property rights of those white males.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And think about it. Like, and we built a economic system based on that, that further marginalized people. And I think it's just my favorite words are, you know, systemic and structural. It's systemic and structural.
We also talked about, we talked about these characterizations. Earlier this month, a man in Western North Carolina was arrested for trying to plant a bomb at an airport in Asheville. He was preparing to fight a war on U.S. soil. That was the quote. And this may be the first time any of our listeners are hearing about it.
It was just amazing. The New York Times ran a little story, itty-bitty story on him. And I just kept thinking, I recalled... I think, was it in 2002 where the gentleman had...
Well, the shoe bomber.
The shoe bomber.
Yeah, yeah.
And the kind of...
We're still taking our shoes off.
Yes.
And so the whole... He was considered crazy.
Absolutely.
Nobody, even the terrorist, wouldn't take credit for him because he was a little off balance.
Yeah, so we changed our entire airport protocol based on this one guy, right?
Who didn't succeed and couldn't have, by
yes,
all accounts.
And yet... This man is about to blow up the Asheville airport, and there's nothing. We see nothing actually problematic. Not that it's even problematic. Again, the narrative is, was he mentally ill? Was there something wrong with him? Because what was the break? So I'm really interested in this idea of breaking and what breaks people. And
because it suggests that you start out normal. So in other words, you get the platform normal to begin with, and then you're broken.
Yeah. And then the break comes because of something outside of themselves, and also because of their capacity to love and care. And the break comes from something inherently good, not something inherently bad.
Talking today with UNC Professor of Communications Kumarini Silva on the state of things. So this brings us to creating categories, because of course we do want to defend ourselves against what we would perceive to be as a threat, and we would like for authorities to be on the alert for some form of threat. And so how do we do this? And I wonder what your take is on this FBI designation now, this new designation that they apparently didn't want us to know about, but Foreign Policy Magazine found this fairly lengthy report on black identity extremists now identified by the FBI.
So it's interesting, Frank, that you asked me what do I think about this. I feel like I could start a whole another hour-long conversation on this. Right. But, you know, I think this is exactly one of the things that I talk about in my book, is that since 2001, our focus on terrorism as a uniquely brown problem, and that it was brownness that was problematic, and that the national focus should be on brownness, and that this kind of terrorist activity came at the expense of American safety and security, allowed people to push aside or ignore the unresolved anti-black sentiments that this country has long had.
Yeah, but in this case, the FBI has also identified white extremists, neo-Nazis. I mean, they have a number of categories that they find as potential threats to the U.S. And some of them are distinctly and politically white supremacists.
But I think what happens with this designation is that there is no identified group that falls under this category, right? Like, so it is much like brown, that's abstract and can be designated to anybody at any time. This designation also can be applied to anybody at any time. So if you see, and I think in that article that you're referencing, I think the Washington Post had that wonderful article on that. What the two authors point out that this is a way for the state to enact their policies by designating this category, so that if they see anybody who is against their policies, they can all be disciplined under this particular identity.
Because under those other groups, there are particular groups that have been identified and have either, for one reason or another, come to the FBI's attention. But as you point out, there is no particular group or individuals in this case, who've been identified. It's just opened up a category, and now you can put
absolutely
anybody into it.
It's no different than saying terrorists, but then the terrorists having a particular demographic that we know about, so that allows that random people to be put under that category.
So what's the antidote to this? How do you? And I've given you maybe 30 seconds now for how we fix it. There you go. That's what we do.
How do we fix it? Yeah. We start talking about it honestly, I think, and to recognize that this country is inherently built on racism, that the myth of the meritocracy has held sway for far too long, and that we face the mythology of that, and that at no point in its history has the country ever been just to all populations, and that this might be a time that we can have a conversation where we could actually build up a just society.
This is the start. Thank you so much for getting us started, Kumarini Silva. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Kumi is a professor of communications at UNC Chapel Hill, studies media, global politics, and its influence on race and gender, and the author of Brown Threat, Identification in the Security State. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.